This is a Saturday Night Live, 31st Day of Sobriety, speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California, on July the 15th, 2000. Our speaker is Keith C. of Indian Wells, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
I don't fall down anymore. I hope. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love participating in any way, you know, cleaning the toilets, making the coffee, and just any way. And I call myself a talker. I'm not a speaker. You know, they called me up. They said, will you please become our guest speaker? No, I can't do that, you know. And, well, you know, I'll become your guest talker. Oh, okay, okay. And the reason I say that is because it's one drunk talking to another drunk that makes this thing possible. Bill and Bob, one drunk talking to another drunk, started the whole thing. And this is Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. There's 182 groups that go by the steps in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. 182. Sex Anonymous, you know. Narcotics Anonymous, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, and I think that's fabulous, you know. But a couple of people, and don't get me wrong, I'm just saying this because this is where I come from, identify themselves as addicts. Well, if you're an addict, you could be addicted to Pepsi-Cola, you know, or you could be addicted to, you know, to reading or whatever you want, you know. So I think where I come from, I was taught to, if I'm in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, identify as an alcoholic, you know. And if you're some other meeting, identify and have respect for that group and everything. And hope you don't, you know, take it wrong. I just think that we have to maintain Alcoholics Anonymous as Alcoholics Anonymous the rest of our life. So my grandkids and their grandkids and your grandkids can have the respect, you know, that, hey, we started this thing, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous started this thing, you know. So I love it. I love every bit of it. I love every part of it. And I'm just happy to be here. I think that the way I found the peace and the happiness that I have today, the peace and happiness I have today, I found from a group called the Pacific Group in Los Angeles and from a sponsor named Clancy. I didn't know who the hell Clancy was. It was a stupid name when, you know, they said, who are you going to call Clancy, you know? Anyway, you know, I found what I have today. Not really because of the big book. Not really because of the 12 traditions, the steps. And it's part of it, naturally, part of it. But I found what I have today because of commitment and because of doing something. If I tell you I'm going to do something, I do it today. And I never did that before. I mean, I was an egotistical maniac before. I, you know, I wouldn't listen to people that tell me what to do, you know. Screw them. I know better than they do anyway, you know. But I didn't realize I had a maniac up here. I got a maniac up here, and I've had it since I was born. And that maniac has always given me bad directions. Bad direction, you know. And I certainly, you know, got to know that I had to release the power of my ego and my maniac to another human being. Called a sponsor, you know. I mean, that's what sponsors are for. And if you don't have a sponsor tonight, I think you should get one. Because we alcoholics can't do it our way. I don't know of an alcoholic in the world that can do it his way or her way. Because of the ego. Because of, I believe I have a set of alcoholic emotions up here. And I can't seem to live with the emotions I have with them out there, those people out there that don't understand me. And they don't understand you, you know. We're different. That's why we always say, Jesus, my case is different, you know. Or you don't understand. How many times have we said that? You just don't understand, you know. I don't fit in that way. You know, and today, you know, I very seldom have a bad day. I got sober July 20th, which is next week. July 20th, 1967, which gives me 33 years next week. And, you know, before I got to this program, and sometime into the program, you know, I used to have those horrible, horrible feelings of, you know, I'm never going to be okay. Nobody's ever going to love me. I'm different, you know. I have that knot in my gut, you know, that horrible pain. That's the worst pain a person can have, you know, when they just cannot accept themselves. And I could never accept myself. Don't get me wrong. I had short spurts. I kind of call myself 75%er. I could climb up that ladder about 75% of the way most of my life prior to becoming a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but always to fail. Wham! I would fail. And I, Jesus, what the hell happened? I mean, why can't I be like them, you know? Why can't I be like those bankers and those great athletes? And, you know, Jesus, what the hell is wrong with me? But we alcoholics have a way of conjuring up a great story, you know? And then I start thinking, well, now if I change this and change that, I'll be okay, because I was doing it. I was going in the right direction, you know? My life was pretty damn good. So there I go again, you know? I'm climbing up that ladder of success again, you know? But I always failed. Always failed before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am not a failure anymore. And if you're sitting in this room with sobriety, you're not a failure anymore. You know, I have 33 years of success because I have not taken a drink or a mind-affecting anything. I have not taken a drink in my whole 33 years, you know. That's success. Now, you got to couple that success with a few other things, like action, you know, doing the right thing. Do the do's and don't the don'ts is a good statement, because, you know, I used to do the don'ts before, thinking I would, you know, people would like me because I screwed up, because I couldn't seem to get your attention or you to like me being a good guy, you know. So even when I was a little kid growing up, I felt that way, you know. I just felt that way. I believe that I have a disease called alcoholism, and I believe that disease has nothing to do with drinking. I believe that disease has caused me not able to fit in the world in sobriety. You know, when I'm drinking, man, I'm happy and joyous, and I'm kicking butt. You know, I'm really going, having a good time until you get so drunk, you know, you go into a blackout and you do horrible things. But alcohol, you know, gives me that feeling, gives me that ability, gives me that drive, that determination to really do something and go after them. Whatever I'm going after, you know. But then I'd get sober, you know, and God, you know, reality sets in sobriety, you know. Jesus, I really am not that nice guy I want to be. You know, I've just been screwing up so much, you know, and God, I get those horrible feelings, you know, horrible feelings that I couldn't fit in and everything. So I'd go drink. And if you drink, they go away. They go away. It's a beautiful thing for an alcoholic to drink. It's a beautiful thing, you know. The only problem is, you know, you can never, ever, ever be happy, joyous, and free on a continuing basis. I could never, ever be successful in anything I ever did. I had 61 jobs before I got here. Don't laugh. It takes a lot of energy to get 61 jobs. And I've had 24 since I've been sober, you know. So, I mean, you newcomers, it don't happen just like that, you know. I mean, you think that you have to be sober 5 to 6 to 8 to 10 years to really start feeling what this thing is all about. And don't get me wrong, those first 4 or 5 years were fabulous in AA for me, because I got involved and I got committed and I got able to do all these things. I owed over $100,000 when I got sober, and screw it, I didn't even go to work. I let my wife go to work, because I loved AA. I loved going to those meetings. I went to 17 meetings a week my first 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't work, you know, which probably in a lot of people's minds, those people out there, was wrong, you know. But I'll tell you something, you know, it started me on a path that I am so very, very, very grateful. I started sponsoring people early in AA. I started being involved with people in an early way. I started doing things in an early way and I screwed up, and I made mistakes, and I, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But what it has caused me to do is stay sober almost 33 years within a week. It's my wife and I, I got married to her when she was 16 and I was 18, and they said it'd never work. Well, we just celebrated 51 years, you know. That ain't bad. Now, don't give me any credit. Give her the credit. I have one more day in AA and she has an Al-Anon. I'll never let her forget it, right? Hooray for the AA, you know. She always comes back and says, well, Bill has that book as Bill sees it. Lois has that book. Lois remembers, you know. God, she remembers, you know. I believe that the moment I swam out of my mother's womb and let out the first cry as a baby, I believe that was an alcoholic cry. I believe that God, as I understand today, and God, as I know him today, has given me these set of alcoholic emotions that I could never function with. I believe that I was different from the very get-go. I was different than them, than Bill and Dick and Sally and Susie and the rest of them. Because, I'll tell you a little story. My kindergarten teacher came up to me and she says, Keithy? Now, you know, I'm in kindergarten. Why wouldn't I want to be called Keithy, you know? If a normie was called Keithy and had the name Keith, he probably wouldn't have said anything. But I said, Mrs. Fullerton, my name is Keith. I wanted to be a man in kindergarten, for Christ's sakes, because I knew I wasn't a man. I wanted to be a man because I knew I wasn't a man. And she, you know, she looked down at me. She says, well, Keithy, you've been chosen to recite a poem at the Easter pageant. And I says, Mrs. Fullerton, I said, you don't understand. You know, I can't do that. And I knew I couldn't get up in front of all these kids, you know. I just knew I couldn't do and do it to perfection, you know. And if you can't do something to perfection, you know, they won't like you. God won't like you. Nobody will like you if you can't do it to perfection in our mind, in this mind. An alcoholic of my type, I really believe that, you know. So she just said, well, you're going to do it, and walked away. So I did the next best alcoholic thing. What I did is I went home, took that little prayer poem, and I went home and I practiced and I practiced and I practiced. We're the greatest practicers in the world, aren't we? You know, because we know we got to do it right. And I practiced that stupid poem. I hated the poem. I hated going to be able to be called up to the podium in the Easter pageant, you know, to recite this stupid poem. But the day came, you know, and they called me up. They said, Keithy, would you please come up? And I, you know, mad again, got up that podium, you know, and I said, twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder where you are. To perfection. I didn't miss a beat. And I got the thing that I was striving for and didn't even know it. I got the thing that everybody in this room has done great things, achievement, and horrible things to get. I got approval. God Almighty, it was wonderful. Oh, God, you did such a good job, Keith. I mean, all my friends and all my girlfriends, you know. And, you know, from that moment to this moment, I have overachieved for your approval. I've underachieved for your approval. I've lied for your approval. I've certainly written enough hot checks for your approval because I'm a convicted felon, you know, for writing hot checks. And all I did is write them for you, you know. I didn't write them for steal money. I'd go in the bar, you know, and I was selling cars in the early years when I got through playing football. I was selling cars. And you work a half a day and you drink a half a day, you know. I'd go in that bar and people would be in that bar and they'd be laughing and the jukebox would go on. They'd be dancing, you know, and drinking that stuff. And I'd sit down, you know, and felt miserable, you know, because I'd sit there all by myself, you know. So what I had to do to get their approval and get their attention is whip out the checkbook. And I knew there was no money in the checkbook, but I didn't give a damn about that. You know, I said, hey, Potts. Potts Back Door is the name of the place. I said, come on over here. I said, get everybody a drink, you know. Hey, guys and girls, it's on me. God, they loved me, you know. And I felt so good about that, you know. So I just set out after kindergarten to just to be the best I could possibly be. I set out for perfection. As it says, we strive for not for perfection, but we want perfection in our life, you know. And, man, my life, you know, got pretty good for a while, and then it got bad, and then it got good, and then it got bad, you know. I ended up as the class president in my sixth grade, you know, and I felt pretty good about that, you know. And I ended up getting into high school, and I was always wanted to be a great athlete. I just wanted to be a good athlete. I said, athletics, you know, athletes, you know, they're strong and people like them, you know, and it's fun. And I used to love the working out and the pain of working out. I loved it, you know. And I loved sandlot football and basketball. I had a basketball hoop in my backyard, and I shot baskets till on a moonlit night till midnight, you know. I just loved doing all that stuff, you know. And so when I got into high school, I lettered four years in four sports, you know. And I became good. I was good, you know. And I became student body president of East Bakersfield High School, where I grew up, you know. But at age 13, I was funny looking. I mean, I had arms like olive oil, you know, skinny arms. And, man, I wanted an arm like Joe Louis, so I could whip people, you know, and dominate people, you know. And I had hair that's, you know, stuck straight up, you know. And I had acne on my face so bad that I'd look at myself in the mirror and I'd just know that nobody would ever love me. Nobody would ever want to look at me. Nobody would ever want to see me because, I mean, it was terrible, you know. And I was skinny, very skinny. I was just a tall, skinny, ugly-looking human being as far as I was concerned, you know. And my aunt and uncles, my mother is Swedish, and she had nine aunts and four uncles, and two of my Swedish aunts were married into an Italian family, and two brothers married two sisters, and we used to have these big, gigantic Christmas Eve parties every Christmas Eve. And, you know, you'd ride away to the North Pole and for the present you wanted, you know, the tractor that would go over, to call over things, you know. This stupid thing, I remember that so vividly, you know. And I got it this one year, you know. I got a tractor that would climb up over things, you know. God, you know. Santa Claus brought it to me. He came every Christmas Eve at 8 o'clock. Hell, I believed in Santa Claus till I was 21, you know, because he was, you know, he brought me that present, you know, reality, you know, that was reality. Anyway, my cousins, they would try to get me to dance with them. Now, there's no way I was ever going to dance with a girl. There's no way that I was ever going to even be close to a girl because I'm ugly. I mean, I have this ugly, stupid face. I got the skinny arms, you know. And I'm 13, and I hate being 13, and want to be 21, and, you know, all the feelings that we all had, you know. And they start pulling on me. Come on, Keith, you dance with me, dance with me. I said, get away from me, get away. I want to slap him, you know. And finally, I got so aggravated that I went over and went to the bar. It was a big bar in this big old house my uncle Pete owned, and that's where we always had these parties. And I grabbed a bottle of VO and put it under my shirt, and I went back in the back closet. But in the closet, closed the door, and said, maybe I can have as much fun as them. And I threw the top off that bottle, and I started to take a drink. I said, wait a minute. Hey, I'm an athlete. Athletes don't drink. You know, athletes don't smoke. You know, why am I doing this? And I said, ah, screw it, because I felt so miserable. You know, took a big old drink off that damn bottle, you know, and it hit my lips and my throat, and I coughed up. I spit it up. I said, my God, how can they like this stuff? It was terrible. Because I took a big drink, you know. And then I all of a sudden found out why. Because it kind of settled down into the bottom of my tummy. And all of a sudden, that warm, wonderful, fabulous feeling that we alcoholics get from that first drink and the thousandth drink, you know. It just kind of hit me. And my hair felt good. And my toenails felt good. And everything in between. And I said, my God, let's have some more. I drank 8 or 10 shots out of that whiskey bottle, and I went out and learned how to jitterbug that night. I became Clark Gable, you know. I became John Wayne. I became, you know, whatever I wanted to become. I learned how to talk that night. People listened to me, you know. God, nobody ever listened to me before, you know. I just kind of started to fit in. I thought, my God, this is marvelous. And, you know, I got so drunk because I kept going back to the closet and drinking it. I drank the whole bottle, you know. Walking home, which was two houses away, you know, I remember throwing up profusely, you know, and throwing up blood for crying out loud, you know. And I said, I don't care. I don't care if it is that way. This is what I'm going to do the rest of my life, you know, and I did. From 13 to 38, I drank as often as I could drink. I drank every time I could drink. That doesn't mean that you can do that, because you can't drink consistently. Sooner or later, it comes out of every pore in your body, right? You know. And I started out in life. And I was going to be somebody. I wanted to be somebody. I wanted that approval I got from reciting that stupid poem in kindergarten, you know. I wanted to be somebody, and I never could be. Short spurts, I could be somebody, and then boom, it would disappear. I would fail again, you know. And I had a scholarship to Stanford University, a football scholarship. And I had a ticket to go up and back in the springtime. And I went up there, and Marcy Schwartz was the coach, and, you know, they put me up in this fraternity, and, God, all these kids, you know, they had $100 bills in their pockets, and they were driving convertibles, and their dads were doctors or lawyers, you know. Well, my dad, who was a fabulous father, just unbelievable. He had a gold mine, a tungsten mine up in the high Sierras, and we used to go fishing every weekend, and he just was a great guy. Well, he died when I was 9 years old of a sudden brain tumor. And when he died, you know, I was going to Christian Science Sunday School, and I believed in God and Jesus, Mary Baker Eddy, and I was a pretty good little religious kid, I guess, you know. And when he died, my aunt walked into the bedroom just as I got through saying my prayers, and she said, "I got bad news for you kids. Your dad has just passed away." And God, I looked up the scene, and I says, "God, you dirty SOB, I'll never believe in you again." And I never did. I just turned him off, you know. I set out to be a man. I set out to be somebody. And, you know, it started out to be okay. In high school, when I lettered in four sports in 4 years, I had a buddy named Wino. His name was Joe Garnier, and his mom and dad owned a big restaurant there. Joseph made their own wine. He used to bring me a gallon of red wine and would put it in my locker, and I could go to that locker for 4 years in high school and take a shot of that wine, you know, or a big hug, big jug, a big swig, you know, and get that feeling, you know, that I'm okay. So I always had alcohol to rely on. So I always thought I was a good athlete, I was a good student, I was a good this because I drank. I mean, that was the reason that, you know, I did all those things, you know. Up here, because the maniac was telling me that, you know. Anyway, up to Stanford, and I had to go out on the Bayshore Highway and start hitchhiking home because I had to get away from $100 bills. My mom was working in a laundry for $15 a week, you know. I mean, I had nothing. I was very poor, you know. And I went home and went back to Bakersfield Junior College. And Bakersfield Junior College has been famous for good football teams for many, many years. And that year, we had a guy named Frank Gifford. You remember him? You know, he was our tailback, you know, and I was playing center. And we had about six guys that off of that team went into the pros. We beat Dixie Junior College in St. George, Utah, 96-6, and we gave them the 6 points just to make them feel good, you know. The next week, we played a team from Mexico, and we beat them 105-0, and we didn't give them nothing. We didn't like them, you know. I mean, but, man, we got a lot of recognition, you know. And, God, you know, we strive for recognition, and we got it, you know. God, it's just great to have your picture in the paper and say, oh, you made so many tackles, or you did this, or you did that. God, I loved it, you know, because I got a tremendous ego. You know, we all got tremendous egos. And we have to satisfy that ego consistently. Those people out there in that world don't seem to have to do that. You know, they can screw up and it doesn't bother them. You know, we screw up and we hate it. You know, that's the difference between us. The difference between a person that has this disease called alcoholism and those people out there that live a pretty comfortable life, you know. Not all of them do, but most of them do, you know. Anyway, I used to girl watch. Any girl watchers in here? I bet you are one because you're holding her. Anyway, I used to go over to East Bakersfield High School where I was a big deal, you know, and I used to girl watch because I loved watching girls, you know. And out of the music room came this little gal, and she had long brown hair right down to her fanny, and she had those gorgeous eyes you could see from a mile away, and she had dark olive skin because she was part Indian, you know. And she was very well endowed, and she was bouncing along really good, you know, boom, you know, you know. And she started walking by this car that Tommy Latham and I were sitting in. And I said, "Tommy, who's that?" She said, "I've never seen her before. She's gorgeous, you know." And he says, "Oh, that's Sally Peters. She just moved here from Oklahoma." I said, "Sally Peters?" God, and I watched her, and she was looking over at us. You know, you girls do the same thing, you know. And I says, Tommy, I'm going to marry that girl. Never even met her. Never seen her before, you know. 4 months later, that little lady, she's sitting in the front row here. She and I got married, and she was 16, I was 18, and off to San Jose State for another football scholarship. And they said, you know, naturally when we got married, it'll never work, you're too young, you know, it's just impossible, you know. And hey, we just celebrated 51 years, you know. So it does work, you know. It works if you work at it, you know. Now, I didn't work at it for 18 of those years because I was a drunk, a bad drunk, I was a bad husband, I was a bad father, I was a bad human being most of the time. I had short spurts of being good, we all do, because we want to be good. We don't want to screw up. We want to do those horrible things, you know. And we want to convince him that I'll never, ever, ever take another drink as long as I live. How many times you said that, you know? And we believe that we're going to do that, you know? That's why they believe us. Otherwise, they wouldn't believe it. Why would they not want to believe us then, you know? They believe us because we believe that we're never going to do that ever again in our lives, you know, until the next day or the next week or the next opportunity, you know? So anyway, we got married, and she had two babies, Boom Boom. In 20 months, we had two kids, a little darling girl, a little fabulous little boy, you know. Here we go, you know, off and running. Used to live on Post Street. And Post Street used to have the Greyhound Bus Depot there, and we lived, you know, above the Greyhound Bus Depot. Paid $12.50 a month for the room. So you can imagine what it was, you know. That's all I could afford. I had a scholarship, but they don't give you a lot for, you know, playing football, and especially in those days. I got a room. I had to sweep a room out every night that I never saw, you know, and they gave me, I think it was $46 a month, and bought all my books and everything, you know. And we started out in life, and we were going to, you know, we were going to become people, somebody. We're going to be a husband and a wife and a good father and a good mother, and here we go, you know. And I played 5 years of college football, two at Bakersfield College and three at San Jose State. And my last year I was honorable mention, All-American. Which for San Jose State was pretty good, you know. And so I got drafted by the 49ers. And I thought, my God, this is it. You know, this is my whole life. You know, if I can just make that football team, and buy that little white house with a white picket fence for her and those kids because I was screwing up so bad. On Friday, I'd have $2 or $3 in my pocket, and I'd say, should I go home and buy some milk for my kids? And we had an ice box or ice for my ice box to keep the milk cold for the kids. Or should I go to 10th and Keys and have a beer? Every single time was 10th and Keys and have a beer. And get home, you know, through at 2 in the morning and start home on my bicycle. Didn't have an automobile. Start home on my bicycle, you know, and swerving and, you know. I never got drunk driving for bicycle, my God, you know, but I sure drove like that. And I'd get home, and, you know, and I'd open the door, and she'd be standing there, you know. Where have you been, you know? I just went and I had a couple of beers. How many did you have, you know? You know, where's your willpower? Where's the milk for the babies? You know, just yell and scream and holler, and I hated it, you know. I hated it. I absolutely hated it, you know. And I just didn't want to be like that. And I'd say to myself, you know, I'd say, God, can I just not drink anymore? Because every time I drink, I get in trouble. Every time I drink, I get in trouble. Can I just not drink ever again? And I'd say, okay, I'm not ever going to take another drink as long as I live. And, you know, and that lasted till I was 38 years old. I just kept drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking. Got drafted by the 49ers. I went up there 2 weeks early because I wanted to be better than everybody else. And there was a quarterback named Y. Tittle. He was drafted the same year. And Frankie Albert was the first-string quarterback in those years. And the quarterbacks and the centers had to practice the snap, and we used to practice it to a musical instrument, metronome, whatever they call it. And it had to be perfect. And for 2 weeks, I worked out. And then for the next week, all we did is I centered the ball on the cadence, you know. Because what we were trying to do, what the coach was trying to teach us, was I had to center the ball on the end of the number. Like if it was on two, you know, hut one, hut two, I didn't center the ball until not the T, the T, but the U, you know. And it gave the lineman 6 inches on the defense, you know. So we practiced that and practiced that. Anyway, practice started. We hit the field at 5 in the morning, you know, just football all day long, banging heads and, you know, calisthenics and learning plays and all that. This is preseason. And for 2 weeks, that's 5 in the morning till 9 at night, you know, and that's all we did for Saturdays and Sundays included. So about 4 days into that practice, a little halfback named Joey Arenas, I never forget, hell of a guy. "Hey, Carp, how would you like a beer?" I says, "My God, I can't even call my wife. How the hell are you going to get a beer, you know?" And he says, "Hey, we do it every year." He says, "Put some pillows in your bed. When they check the bed, you know, you won't be there. You'll be with a bunch of guys. We'll go down to the Redwood City. There's a bar in Redwood City we used to go down to all the time. We were practicing at junior college over here next to Stanford. And, hey, you know, I went down there and I sat at that bar with those guys, you know, those real pros, you know, that made me a part of, you know. I felt like I was a part of just for being there. And that's why you have to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't go to AA meetings, you don't find out whether you're going to like it or you don't feel a part of. But I felt like I was a part of that team, and I was no more a part of that team than flying to the moon. It was a weekend of practice, you know. Anyway, the next, I drank 40 beers that night. Joe drank 30. And the rest of the guys, like Leo Nomolini and Frank Albert, they had a couple of beers and they went back to the camp. You know, they're not alcoholics like we were. Next morning, I hit the field at 5 o'clock, and I had a hangover, because I hadn't drank in 3 weeks. And I had a hangover that, man, I'd never felt like having this hangover before, you know. And we had a scrimmage, you know. And I was playing defensive linebacker, and I was supposed to go in and get the quarterback. And, man, I was going to kill him, you know, with this horrible hangover, you know. And I shot through there to get the quarterback, and a guy named Bruno Banducci, 7-time All-Pro, hit me, drove me in the air. My head hit the turf, and it was like a Liberty Bell went off inside. Just like a Liberty Bell went off inside. You know, and I laid there, and you know what I said? "I'll never, ever, ever drink another beer as long as I live. Or drink another drink." And I was serious, and I meant it, you know. Well, it so happened I played 5 years of professional football. I played 1 year with the 49ers, and the Edmonton Eskimos, a guy named Ed Hinkey, played up there, and they called him, and they needed a guy like me, a kind of a utility lineman. And they said, "If whatever your contract is, we'll double it." And my contract in those days wasn't like it is today. I signed out of San Jose State for $4,250 for the whole year and had to bring my own shoes, you know. Y.A. Tittle only got $6,000, you know. I mean, we weren't making money like they make today. So double that, $9,000, man, it was like $1 million, you know. I said, "Honey, we're going." So I packed her up in the car and packed our goods, and we took off for Canada, you know. And as we crossed the Canadian border, this is my wife's story, but it's so true. There was a big sign that said, you know, Foster Kleiser sign that said, "Drink Canada Dry," you know. And she says, "What an order. I think you'll go through with it." And believe me, I did. Oh, God. I drank myself from the 49ers to the Edmonton Eskimos. They traded me to the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. They didn't want me around anymore. They traded me to the Toronto Argonauts because they didn't want me around anymore. They traded me to the Montreal Alouettes because they didn't want me around anymore, and I was through. I never made it as a professional football player. And I had no idea. The reason I did not make that is because I was an alcoholic. I had no idea. Alcohol was a major part of my life. Without alcohol, I couldn't play tiddlywinks, for crying out loud. In my head, you know, I had to have that alcohol. I had to get that feeling, that wonderful feeling. And it destroyed the thing that I wanted most in my whole life. Moved to Bakersfield, went in the car business, you know. 3 or 4 years later, I was 320 pounds and going through bankruptcy, and, you know, I was a horrible human being. I was a horrible human, getting in trouble after trouble, you know, writing those hot checks, you know, just a horrible human being, and couldn't figure out that alcohol was my... You know what I really thought? I really thought that I was one of these human beings that God put on this earth that was never going to make it, you know. It got to the point where I was such a failure, and in my head, I was such a failure that I was never, ever going to make it. Never going to make it. And I didn't, you know. I did make it, you know. And I said, "Honey, we got to move to Los Angeles, the land of milk and honey, you know, and start all over again." And we took off, went to Los Angeles, you know. The only problem there is you take yourself. you know. I had no idea that I was a problem. My sponsor, when I was brand new, said, get the best looking picture you can find of yourself, put it on the mirror in the bathroom, and every morning when you get up and look in that mirror and you see your picture, you say, that's the problem. You know, because I didn't believe that was a problem when I got here. I think you're the problem, you know. They're the problem, you know. My bosses were the problem. My inability to be consistent. I can never be inconsistent doing anything. I was a shotgun, you know. I just sprayed everything all over, trying to do everything at once. Thank God I married a woman that's pragmatic. She's like a 357 Magnum. She zeros in, you know. These Al-Anons, man, they zero in on you, man, and they're usually right. Makes you feel terrible, but they're usually right, you know. And off I go, you know, starting out. And I was on my 61st job, and I finally went into business for myself. And I was pretty successful. Swimming pool sales and service company. I built the Jane Mansfield swimming pool. Big heart, you know, built the whole pool. And I had Marilyn Monroe as on my route and did thing, you know, her pool. And Red Skull and all these guys, you know, and I was doing, man, I was doing it, man. I was getting that feeling that, hey, this is the time. I'm going to make it, for crying out loud, you know. And I start up that letter, 75%. And at 75%, whammo, I failed again. I woke up, I had 10 accounts left. Everybody was firing me. My wife was taking care of the books and everything, and she was getting letters in the mail, you know. We don't ever want to see Mr. Carpenter in our backyard ever again. My wife caught him urinating in the swimming pool this morning, you know. I don't remember doing that, you know. And I became a failure again. A failure again. Here I am, you know, I'm a felon. I got convicted of writing hot checks and damn near went to prison. Came that close. You know. Here I am, my 61st job, and, you know, from the time I was a kid, you know. I mean, a failure. I've been a failure all my life, you know. Just didn't know what I was going to do, you know. So my wife came to me one day and she says, I made an appointment at the National Council on Alcoholism. And she says, you're going to go with me. You have a problem with alcohol. And I says, get off my back, you know. I don't have a problem with alcohol. I says, just, okay, I have a hell of a hangover this morning. She says, you usually do, you know. And I said, I'll go if you don't yell and scream and holler at me this morning. And she says, okay, I promise. And off we go down Wilshire Boulevard. And I sat in this office with this guy for an hour and a half, listened to his story, you know. He was making a 12-step call. I didn't know that, you know. I don't remember a word he said. I remember he gave me 9 glasses of water, and that's all I remember. And she was upstairs talking to a gal in Al-Anon. We left, and, you know, for 9 more months, I kept drinking and kept trying to figure out a way to commit suicide because I just didn't want to exist anymore the way I was, you know. I'd go up on Mulholland Drive and have 2 cold 16-ounce cans of beer between my legs and just sip that beer and just try to figure out, you know, why can't I be like them driving down the freeway with suits on? I didn't own a suit to my name, you know. Why can't I be somebody, you know? And I just know I can't, so how can I just end it all? You know, I try to figure out, how the hell can I end it all, you know? And thank God I didn't, you know. And on July 19th, 1967, I had been drinking it for that 9 months profusely. For the last 3 weeks I drank 40 half quarts of beer and a fifth or fifth and a half of scotch or whiskey if I could beg, borrow, or steal it, you know. And I got to the point where I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober. I was in that limbo. Horrible, horrible place for an alcoholic, you know, because it's not working. It's just not working. And I started thinking, what the hell am I going to do, you know. So I took off for Bakersfield because I was born and raised with all the Basque people up there. They have the greatest food in the world. If you ever been to Bakersfield, go to a Basque restaurant. It's fabulous, you know. And they always put a glass of, a bottle of wine in front of you. And I didn't have much money, and I drove this pickup up there. It was a year and a half old. Didn't have a straight fender in it, you know. Both bumpers wired up, you know. But I'd never hit anything, you know. I mean, but it was an alcoholic truck. You see him all the time, you know, with a dog in the back. And I had my dog, Duke, in the back, you know. And he got sober with me, though, finally. Nate and Seal at the Woodland Hills beer bar used to bought him a big dish that he put the beer in, and a big dish or big thing that he put the popcorn in, and Duke would come running in there and And he'd get drunk, man. And, you know, he could jump over the back of my truck, you know, if he was sober. He got to the point where I had to lift him up and put him in the truck, you know. But he got sober with me, thank God. Anyway, I drove home. Didn't know how I got home because I was really drunk. I started eating that bass food and drinking that wine, and I threw up all over the table. And I was so embarrassed, I just took off, you know. Jean-Pierre, I knew him, you know, since I was a kid, for crying out loud. I was just so embarrassed, you know, and I took off, went home. I got home, and I went to bed, and I woke up the next morning probably with the most severe hangover I've ever had in my life. While Sally was down there talking to that girl at the National Council on Alcoholism, when we walked out, Frank handed her a phone number, and he said, he isn't ready. When he gets ready, maybe he'll call this number, you know. And so that morning, I flopped out of that bed, and I couldn't stand up. I was fat. I was that roly-poly fat and red face, you know. And I was so hungover, I tried to get up from the bed, and I couldn't get up. So I crawled on all four into the porcelain altar, you know. Been there many times, you know. And I lifted up the wooden seat, and I'm going, oh, man, I'm really giving it my best, you know. And this gal that I'm married to, this pragmatic Al-Anon, which she didn't know she was, she had taken that number. We had a little gun machine where you could get the numbers and paste them on things to identify, you know, swimming pool equipment. And she'd taken that, she put it across the refrigerator. She put it in the hall phone. She put it in the bedroom on the glass, the mirror. She put it in the stupid bathroom on the mirror. She put that number all over the house. And I used to see it. I'm never going to call AA. She wouldn't do that. And I'd rip them off and she'd put it up again, you know. And I started vomiting in this toilet bowl. And I looked up that seat. And I looked down on the porcelain. It was 3922636. And I said to myself, oh, my God, maybe I better call AA, you know. And I kind of cleaned myself up, and I got myself up and got myself straightened around, you know, but just miserable, horrible hangover, vomit, you know, all over me. You can't get it all off, you know. And I went into the hall phone, and I dialed that number. It was 20 minutes to 9, July 20th, 1967. The man answered the phone, you know. And, you know, we alcoholics are, you know. I said, I straightened up, you know. I said, sir, is this where I'm supposed to call if I have an alcohol problem? You know, real professional, you know. And he says, well, tell me, do you think you have an alcohol problem? And I said, well, I don't know about that, but my wife's divorced me, and my kids hate me, and I got him. Wait a minute, kid. He says, you're an alcoholic, you know. And I says, who the hell are you, you know? How can you, have you ever met me? And he says, no, I haven't met you, but I know. And we know, you know, we just know, you know. And he says, you're an alcoholic, you know. And I thought he hung up on me. God, I was so devastated off, you know. And I went out and got my pickups. She had a little job. She was trying to get enough money to divorce me. And, you know, I opened the door of the truck. And this little gal, she had a habit of taking all the extra beer cans, you know, in the paper sack. I'd throw them in the back of the truck or put them underneath the seat, you know, to hide them. There'd be 40 or 50 of them. She'd pyramided them so when I opened the door, they'd fall on me. Then she'd take the ones that had beer left in it and pour it on the seat. So I'd kick in those damn cans, you know, and I got in there and went, squish! Oh, God, you know. I'm going to divorce that woman. I hate her. You know, I was in bad shape. I was in bad shape. And I went back, and then I remembered Clancy was the one I called. I didn't know who the hell he was. And he says, I'll call you back. And I stared at the phone, and he called me back. And he sent a guy out for a 12-step call and took me to a meeting that night. I had this suit on that didn't fit. I couldn't get it around. And it was hot. It was July 20th. I was sweating profusely, and I was this big, big ball of jelly. I was fat, you know. And God, and I hated myself, and I hated the fact that I couldn't fit my suit on me, and I was sweating, you know. And went to the meeting, and Clancy was the speaker, and Bob, this guy made the 12-step call. He says, go ask him to be your sponsor. And I says, well, what do you mean, sponsor? He says, just go ask him. And I said, well, do we sponsor Little League here, you know? And I said, he says, no, just go ask him, you know. And thank God that I went and asked him, you know. Didn't know what the hell I was asking. Didn't want to do it. hated being there, hated myself, hated every human being in that meeting, you know. It's a horrible, 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 horrible outlook on life, would say. And I says, I was told to ask you to be my sponsor, you know. And he says, well, kid, he says, if you'll do everything that I tell you to do from this moment forward, he says, I'll sponsor you, you know. I said, okay. You know, I mean, I didn't even hear him, you know. But thank God. You know, thank God for a guy like me, an egotistical maniac, you know, that was trying to be somebody all his life and never made it. Thank God, you know, that sponsor, and it's not Clancy, it's just a sponsor, was capable and able to give me the proper direction to turn me into the human being that God wanted me to be, you know. And I think that really happens to us in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. He told me the first two things he told me. He says, just go to meetings. He says, sit at the front of the meeting and just don't talk. Don't say anything. And I said, how long I got to do that? He says, till I tell you you can. And I went to these meetings, you know, and I started liking these meetings, you know. I really started liking the meetings. And things started to feel pretty good about who I was and what I was, you know. The first two things he says, if you say you're going to do something, do it. If you say you're going to show up at 6:45 on Monday night to somebody, be there. Get there early. He says, if you do those two things, he says, your life will change profusely. And I said, hey, I'll give it a try. And I gave it a try. And I've never had to go out and take a drink since I got here. And I really believe the reason for that is because I had such strong direction, and the Pacific Group was such a strong meeting of structure and principles, you know, that I became slowly the person I've always wanted to become, the human being that I've always wanted to become, you know. And life was damn good. I told Clancy that I'm never going to believe in God. He says, that's all right, just go to meetings. Just go to meetings. About a year into going to meetings, 17 a week I went to for the first year. About a week into, about a month, 9 months into that first year, AA just wasn't working for me. I'd sit in those chairs, my back had hurt. Those speakers up there, they're lies. They're not telling proper stories. You know, I can't believe those stories, you know. And I had a buddy that could get me a job in Saudi Arabia making $10 billion, you know, and I said, that's where I'm going, you know. I want to come back and, you know, if anybody wants a loan, I'll give it to them, you know. I wanted to be a big shot, you know. I wanted to be a big shot. So one thing led to another, and I called Clancy. I says, I'm leaving. I hate you. I hate AA. I'm going to Saudi Arabia. He says, well, he says, before you do that, will you come have one cup of coffee? He didn't say two or have coffee. He says, one cup of coffee. And I said, okay, I'll do it. Went down there, and he says, I walked into his office. He says, see the door? He says, get the hell out of here. And don't let the door hit you in the rear, and go take the third step. I says, okay, you know, and I started out. And wait a minute, you're my sponsor. I don't know how to take the third step. I can't take the third step. He says, you better well damn do it. He says, I can't tell you how. If you have an honest desire to take the third step, you'll do it. And out the door I went, in my pickup, this old beat-up pickup, with my dog Duke, sober Duke, you know. I mean, I just drive down the freeway, and I went, how do I do this? What do, you know? And I said, you know, well, I said, maybe, you know, I can just, if I believe everything that I've heard in AA, you know, and I can accept that word, accept, we hear it all that, accept the seemingly, we hear it all the time, accept the seemingly bad things that happen to me as well as the good things as necessary for my growth, you know, maybe that's the way I can turn my will over to God, is I don't understand and don't want to turn over to. I went home that night and I put in a form of prayer. I said, dear God, as I understand, please help me to accept the seemingly bad as well as the good things necessary for my growth. Amen. I said, okay, I'll say it for 3 weeks. You know, test the waters. And 2 weeks later, I had a seemingly tremendous heart attack. I passed out in the nest. I woke up and I had knives jabbing me in the heart. You know, I mean, I was having a heart attack. And they're trying to help me. They put wallets in my mouth. They didn't want me to, I don't know, choke on myself. I don't know. Anyway, I said, leave me alone, leave me alone. And I got up and I took 3 steps and I passed out and I woke up in the ambulance and was siren was screaming, you know, and I was sweating. And I was, dear God, as I understand, please tell me. Dear God, as I understand. I kept saying that prayer over and over and over again to get to the hospital. And Mary Regan, a gal that ran the nest, happened to be working there. They were wheeling me in on the gurney, and she came over and grabbed my hand. She said, everything's going to be all right, like AA's do to, you know, everybody in the world. And 4 days later, I get out of the hospital, and on the medical report, it said obesity and irritable bowels, period. You know, a little gas escaped underneath my... But the prayer worked. A week later, my daughter, she was 19 years old, and she was gorgeous. Tall, blonde, beautiful figure. Just gorgeous girl. She came to Sally and I, and she says, Mom, Dad, I'm going to move in with Joe. Joe was sitting at the kitchen table with a hat on with those dingleberries hanging down and a hog motorcycle out in front and a known doper, you know. And I said, Joe, you're not going to do that to us. And I went nuts, you know. We alcoholics can go crazy in sobriety. And I started yelling and screaming at her. And I took Joe by the seat of the pants in the back of the neck and threw him through the plate glass window. Could have killed him. Just threw him. And he went out and got on that motorcycle. He took off. He didn't want part of me, you know. And I started counseling my daughter, you know. I yelled, I screamed, I hollered, I spanked her. She's 19 years old. I went nuts that she would do something like that to, you know, her mother and her father, you know. And she said, she went to bed that night and she took off the next morning. I went to Clancy. He said, what do I do about this? I have no control over this. He said, no, and you never will. He said, you're right about it. I said, what do you mean right about it? You're right about it. Just write and write and write till you're through. And I wrote about it, she was working at the Van Nuys Airport, washing airplanes, and I handed her this 8 pages of written, you know, 10-step really. And I walked away. I said, Kim, you know, if you ever need me or your mother, we're going to be available, but we can't allow to be a part of your life today, you know, because she was really bad into drinking. She drank a gallon of wine at Christmas, selling Christmas trees, and she gave all the Christmas trees away. And she was into cocaine and, you know, all the drugs and everything, you know. Anyway, another week went by, and got a call at 7:30 in the morning from the hospital. Said, we think we have your daughter here. She's listed as a Jane Doe. Would you come try to identify her? I said, identify her? Well, she's in intensive care. What they were doing, her and her buddy Joe, her boyfriend, were going Topanga Canyon on a dope run, you know, and they had no identification or anything, and the car turned over and half her face was torn off. Her beautiful, gorgeous face. She really, really was. And got to the hospital, and the doctor came up to us and met us and said, Mr. and Ms. Carpenter, we know it's your daughter now because somebody came in and identified her. She's in intensive care. She's been operated on 7 times, and she probably will not live. And the only thing I can suggest is to go to the chapel we provide in this hospital and pray to the pray to the God of your understanding. I don't know if doctors say that, but this one did, and thank God. And I called Clancy. He was there in 5 minutes from Venice. Sally and Clancy and I went down to this little chapel, and on our knees, we prayed to the God of our understanding. The only prayer I know was, you know, please, dear God, please help me to accept this seemingly bad thing as necessary for my growth and my daughter's growth, you know. Anyway, she made it. She came out of intensive care about 3 weeks later, and she was in the hospital for 2 or 3 months. And she got out, and she came to the Pacific Group and went to other meetings, and then she'd drink and she'd use, you know. And for 17 years, she drank and used. And my sponsor says, sit halfway back at the beginning and sit there and don't talk about it with anybody. And that was good advice because Sally and I, she got involved with her Al-Anon. I got involved with my AA, and we just went forward, you know. And May 23rd, she celebrated 14 years of sobriety after using and drinking for 17. You know, so she made it, you know. But she still has a bad scar because they could never make it right. It was just in a position where it was just never make it right. But she's got a tremendous attitude. She lives in Pony, Montana, and she runs the whole state of Montana AA. You know, she tries, you know. And we love her, just love her. So things can happen in sobriety. The seemingly bad things can happen. But if we accept those seemingly bad things as necessary for our growth, God, they become part of our story. They become part of our individual growth, for crying out loud, you know. I have a son, Keith, who never wrote a bad check in his life, signed his shoes, you know, always was good at everything, you know. And he and I started a little company 10 years ago called Woodstone. We make big pizza ovens, you know. And we sell them to California Pizza Kitchen and Wolfgang Puck and Willow Street Pizza in here in town. We sell them all over the world. I travel all over the world selling these damn ovens, you know. And God, you know, I never thought that would be ever possible for me to become successful at something. My son's the president, I'm the vice president, and we run our business kind of like AA. When you call Woodstone, you get a person. You never get an answer machine. You know, I don't like calling places and getting that stupid answering machine, you know, that stupid voicemail. And we have built that company, and hey, we're doing really good. We're doing good. My youngest son, Kyle, he started drinking and using when he was 8, and just recently he got sober. About three years ago, he got sober, but he drank and used all those years. My life is good today, you know. My ego is still there, you know. And if you don't mind, I'll sing you a song. I'll sing you a song. It's the alcoholic theme song. And I'm sure that everybody will identify with this song. I, me, I, me. Identification. I believe that you got to get busy. I believe that you got to get commitments. I believe that you got to have a sponsor. I believe you got to follow the sponsor's direction whether you want to or not. I believe that you got to eliminate the maniac from your head and you become successful in this life that you've always wanted to become successful in. I had a sponsor, a grand sponsor named Chuck Chamberlain before he died. He was Clancy's sponsor. And we went a lot of places with him and heard him talk a million times, you know. And he was a fabulous guy. And Chuck used to always say, almost every time he talked, not all the time, almost every time he talked, he used to say, you know, he says, if we alcoholics in this meeting tonight really, really believe in the Lord's Prayer, if we really believe in the Lord's Prayer, and we really believe the first two words, what are the first two words? Our Father. If we really believe that, when we take hands tonight, and we say, Our Father, that is saying God is our Father and we are His kids. And I thank you.